Okay, I am going to try and record this, but I have realized just now that I got the wrong power switch, the power cord, so it'll just stop somewhere in the middle. Let's see what we can do for that. Okay, it'll record as much as it can, and then the rest we just have to deal with it. So we are going to talk about indexing and tolerant dictionaries. The indexing part is going to be very useful for your project, part A, because you would actually be doing inverted indices. They gave everything, all the data structures that you need, and you would be doing the inverted indexing and based on that ranking, okay? That is a minimal required part. And then the other things that I would talk about today, because they're also relevant, are tolerant dictionaries, which essentially means if I write a word in the query, if there are some other words that are closer, maybe I misspelled this word, okay? Then can you find other correct words that are closer to this word? And then also search for them. That's the basic idea. So that's tolerant dictionaries. And you have that also happening normally and in search engines, for example. In traditional IR, actually, they also allow wildcard queries. That means a query where in the term you will put a star in the middle. Okay. I won't talk too much about it in this class because it's not really been all that popular in the web queries because people don't, most search engines don't really support wildcard queries. And also, people don't seem to be using wildcard queries as much, okay? In traditional IR, there is a lot of discussion on how to effectively support wildcard queries, which also will be related to tolerant dictionaries. Which also will be related to tolerant dictionaries because essentially you are looking for all words starting with some some string or ending in some string. Okay, so that's the basic things that we will cover. And towards the end, we'll also cover, depending on the timing, we'll also cover distributed indexing. And distributed indexing basically is when the index is so large that it can't sit on a single, it can't sit on a main memory, and it can't even sit on a single machine. And so in that case, how would you, construct indexes? Most of today's class is really data structure stuff, okay? And so it's a bit of a variation from that. And so the expectation is that we'll go from 10:30 to 11:45, so it's already like 10:35, if that Big Bang thing actually works, we might actually have to stop before that. For those of you who are keeping track, Hadron Collider started, and they're going to start they're going to recreate the conditions of Big Bang, and there are doomsayers who are thinking that, in fact, the Big Bang might happen, in which case they may not be Europe or they may not be in America. That's, by the way, the collider in Swiss-German border, I think. And it's a 17-mile radius. It just started yesterday. Anyway, retrieval. So first we'll talk about indexing and retrieval. Let's start. Basically, if you remember what we have done by the last Thursday's class, which was vector similarity ranking, if I get you documents as TF-IDF vectors, and you give me a query as a TF-IDF vector, then I can compute the distance between the document and the query, and then you can rank those documents. So you already know this. All we're going to do today is how to do this efficiently. That's basically what it is, and in some sense that's a very important thing, because if you have a large number of documents, efficiency matters a whole lot. So let's start with the dumb idea. So you really can think of these documents here are the terms and here are the documents, and these weights are the TF-IDF weights of these terms in these documents. You can think of it that way. it's not very important as to which specific weights these mean, whether they're frequency weights, whether they are TF-IDF weights, or they're just TF weights, I don't care, you know. And then, of course, since you do have to normalize, you basically normalize with respect to the, for each of these documents, you also keep track of this NF normalization factor, which is essentially the reciprocal of its magnitude, because you just have to multiply that to make up for the size of the document. Okay, we'll assume you'll agree that we don't care to normalize with respect to the query, because query is going to be the same for all the documents, so, you know, the order with whether or not you normalize would be the same. Okay, so this is the kind of data you have, and this will be a very sparse matrix, because hopefully most documents don't contain most terms. Okay. So one very simplistic idea, one obvious idea if you just start writing a program would be to take, suppose I got a query like this, and I do have, in this case I gave the normalization factor for the query, it's not important as I pointed out because the same query is being compared to all the documents. So the question of course is how do you evaluate this query on all these documents and see which is the closest? Okay, first method that would come to your mind probably if you haven't thought about efficiency issues is just compare each query to each of the query to each of the documents one by one by one, you know. And here is a little code which says basically for each document DI, for each term TJ, if it appears in the document, then you basically keep track of the similarity. Remember, vector similarity is dot product. So you can accumulate the pieces for the dot product as given by each of the terms, right? Okay, and then you sort the documents in the descending order of similarities and you give the top k to the user. As far as we are concerned, this is okay, this will work, but the problem, of course, is that it could be extremely slow. In particular, it's going to look at every possible document, okay? And if the document doesn't contain the query, it won't do this. But the point is, you are actually looking at the document. That's where you waste all the time. Okay? So it will be much simpler to do the inverted index solution, which is the one we talked about in passing last time, and we'll go into more detail today, a little more detail. This is really 310 level material. It's not, at this point, it's not particularly exciting or particularly hard to understand. But I'll go through it, as I said, because you would be doing inverted index in the first project here. Okay, so it needs access to all the documents essentially, and what you want is be query driven. Look at each of the terms in the query, and for each term, look at only the document that term actually appears in, and then only for them you compute the weights. Okay, compute the dot product components essentially. Okay, and so you would want to generate a inverted index, and in general, an inverted index, we'll see in a minute, that essentially an inverted index contains the dictionary of words, it's also called lexicon, all possible words, all possible terms that can potentially comprise a query, including misspelled words, okay, and then the retrieval of so that's the lexicon, and from the lexicon there is a pointer to all the document where that term occurs and specific positions in those documents where that term occurs. That's the postings list. Okay, and then given a query, your first job is to find the terms in the dictionary, and then once you find the terms, and from the term there is a pointer to the postings list, and then you traverse these postings list essentially. Okay, and in particular, you have to assume that you would not have forgotten all your 310 stuff, so the best way to find a term, you know, if you have a dictionary and you're trying to locate a word in it, you could do it a couple of ways. You could do it by hashing, or you could do it by using a binary tree sort of a thing, B-tree or binary tree. If it's sorted, then you can, you know, get to it in logarithmic pieces. Okay, now the difference between, we will just assume in the current discussion that hashing is what we'll use, but there is something to be said for tree-based representation for the data structures for the dictionaries, because in particular, if you have a binary search tree, binary tree or a B tree, then it would be easy, for example, to find all the words that start with a prefix. Because the way you would differentiate the binary tree would be, in the top, you would say all the words which start with the first letter A up to H on this branch, and H up to Z, this branch. And then you go down, right? So you could use that to figure out not just the specific word, but also the range of words. Okay, that's like looking forward to the possibility of wildcard queries. Okay, I won't mention too much about that otherwise here. In the retrieval, in the info IR book, there are two chapters, one on dictionaries, one on indexing issues, where they go into a lot more detail than I would go into. So if you are into data structures for indexing and you know, tolerant dictionaries, you definitely want to read those. Okay. Okay, so then you retrieve the occurrences, you basically compute your similarity metric, and then you rank the data, you know, the documents. Okay, so here is an example, one more example of inverted files. So here's a file, and you think of this file in terms of the positions, and then so position 1 here, 10, 20, 30, 36, and so 1, 2, 3, etc. other words. Okay, so you can then talk about, first thing you do is essentially, here you have an inverted file, essentially. It tells you that the word A occurs in positions 1, 4, and 40. The word entry occurs in positions 11, 20, 31, and so on. This is the inverted file just for this file. And you have another file, you can also get an inverted file, and in some sense you can merge them. So if A also occurs in a different file, then so instead of just thinking of the positions, you will also say document position. Okay, so you have one single inverted file which essentially tells you where all this term occurs. For each term, where are all the places where this term occurs in the different files. Okay, so here is a little more baroque looking example here, where I have a lexicon here. This is a part of the dictionary, and these are all the words I have: Jezebel, Jezer, Jezeret, blah blah blah. And for each of these words, this one is telling me in how many documents is this word appearing. Okay, and then there is a pointer to the postings list. That's basically what it's doing. Okay, and the postings list would go like this: the document ID, 34, in which it occurs 6 times, and it occurs first in the first position, then in the 118th position, and so on. Okay, that's basically your postings list. And if I have these postings list for all of these, then I would use them in my, you know, given a query term, I can look at all the places where it's occurring and only start keeping track of the vector similarity for those, in essence. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, there are many small variations on this, but this, if you understand this, this is a good enough place to start from. And now in terms of using it, so all I need to care about is that for each term there is a posting. For each term there's a posting. And that posting essentially goes in terms of the documents, the positions in the documents where that word occurs, and the weight for that document. Okay. One thing I should have mentioned is that this one is only showing the positions. Here it says number 6 as the number of occurrences, but if you want to give a single weight to that word with respect to that document, you provide that also here. Okay. In general, actually, positions are important if you are looking for proximity queries. If you want to make sure that the two words in the query are occurring in the data document, not just in the document, but are also occurring close to each other in the document. For most of our discussion today, we won't care about position. Okay, so we really, all we will care about is that we have at least this information: the document where it occurs in, and the weight of this term with respect to the document. That's it. the TF-IDF weight with respect to the document. Okay, that's the only thing that we'll care about. So I'll assume that there is a lexicon is, you basically put as a hash table, because I don't care as much about the, I don't care at least right now as much about the wildcard queries. So I'll just assume there's a hash table, and then given the term, I can find its hash entry, which will then give me the pointers to its posting list. Okay, and then this is your little retrieval algorithm. It's not particularly hard. The only thing is the files have now changed for each term, for each document that appears in the terms posting list. That's all you did. Okay, so if you remember, if you go back to the old, uglier version, the inefficient version, you're going through each document and you're comparing it to the query. Here you're just starting from the query terms, and you know the postings list, and so you essentially do this same exact operation, but only for the documents which actually appear in the postings list. That's all, okay? And then having done that, so in essence, basically in the beginning, you assume that all the similarities are set to zero for this query, for all the similarities of this document for this query are set to zero, and then you are essentially accumulating the similarities for each of the documents that have that query term. Now, obviously, this has to become more interesting if, in fact, you want to take proximity of the terms into account. Right now, you act as if each of the query term is independent. It's just all that you care about is it's present in the database. If you want to take the proximity into account, you have to compare the position of the query term in the document. So in fact, that's a more interesting retrieval where you would have to follow the postings list of two terms, synchronously. Okay, I won't describe that. It's definitely described in the chapter on any of the indexing chapters, but the one in the textbook is, the one on the IR textbook does have it. Okay, that's basically the inverted file retrieval. That's it. Okay, and it's a huge improvement because it only looks at the documents that are essentially having postings of this term. That's the idea. Okay, now you would use something like this for the project part A, but if you really are into doing the, all that I need is to be that you do this for part A. But if you are into proximity based retrieval, you have to also actually traverse the postings list synchronously and keep the, to see whether or not before you add the component for a query term, you have to see whether or not it's close enough to the other query term. Okay. These are the obvious observations about this method. Basically, you do much less work. Okay, you are query driven and you only consider the documents where the query terms are actually occurring. Okay, and you amortized work by essentially having computed the inverted index up front, so at the retrieval time you're doing much faster. Okay, here is a carefully worked out example. I would not necessarily go through this, but you may want to look at it to make sure that you understood. And if you have any questions about how this kind of a thing works, which should not be there unless you are forgotten your 310 stuff. Okay, but it shows, here is an example, here is a bunch of documents, and here is the postings list, and then it talks about what happens to the similarity array after the T1 is processed, after the after the term 3 is processed, and then after normalization. Okay, up to here I'm assuming essentially that I would compute the similarity for all the documents which have non-zero values, and then sort them. And this sorting phase is going to be costly, depending upon how many documents are there, and you're going to give the top 10 of those documents, or top K of those documents, or show them in the sorted order. Okay, there are a bunch of things that you can do with respect to, and in fact all search engines do, with respect to even this step, where once you realize, as I mentioned a couple of classes back, that vector similarity isn't really what the user is looking for. You hope that that's sort of related to what the user is looking for. So you don't exactly, it's not exactly the end of the world if, you know, if in fact the numbers that you computed are a little wrong, or in fact, you know, you didn't get the exact top 10, you got most of the top 10, but, you know, one of the 12th position ones sneaked into the top 10th position. Okay, once you realize that, then you can do all sorts of things. Basically, what you want to do is, before you even get into this phase, you want to cut down as many documents as you can from the ranking. Okay, now already inverted index is cutting down many documents, because only the documents that are in the postings of any term would actually take part in the ranking. The others won't get touched. But you can do even more. You can, for example, start saying that if it's a 10-term query, okay, any document which contains, let's say 5-term query, you know, there are 5 query terms, any document which contains less than 3 of the 10 terms is not likely to be in the top 10. It's a heuristic, because I can always make a situation where of the 5 terms, really what you care about are, you know, one or two terms that are most important. Okay, so if you make that, you know, you want to support partial retrieval, but at the same time, all I'm saying is, in the top 10, am I likely to, you know, have documents that are going to have just one of the 5 terms in the query? To the extent you don't think that would be the case, then you can cut down before you even start, you know, aggregating their similarity values for each of the documents. You just remove all the documents. Basically, you're doing an intersection on the postings list, okay? And removing all the documents which contain less than 3 of the terms from consideration. So that would be doing less work than this. Okay, you can do a variation of that idea, which might point out that it's not really the number of terms, but the importance of terms that matter. Yeah, obviously, right? So one idea would be to take into account the IDF values of the query terms. IDF values of the query terms, and say that if a document does not contain a query term whose IDF value is higher than a certain threshold, then it cannot possibly be in the top 10 results. Do you understand what I'm saying? So what that would mean is that you'll say, if there is a query which says, this is a purple ball, this and is and a are all very common words. Ball is a little less common. No, in fact, purple may also be common, but, you know, make up some very weird color, you know, teal or something, okay? That would be less common, okay? So it's not the number of words, but if the document doesn't contain some of the high IDF words in it, then you want to start not taking it into account. This is the kinds of ideas that you use to reduce the number of documents that you would actually consider during these phases. And then you only sort those in the end. Okay? This is the usual approximate retrieval idea. And, you know, several search engines do this. We will also consider a different variation of this kind of approximate retrieval idea. Let me actually mention it now, but we'll come back to it in the context of distributed indexes. Suppose I were to do the following thing. Suppose I were to say, it's a different way, which is, instead of being term-centric, I am document-centric. And I say, of all the documents in the world, I split them into barrels. Okay? Split them into barrels. And in the top barrel are the most important documents. Those are the ones people are likely to be interested in having as a result. Okay? The second barrel is second most important. Third barrel is third most important. In general, you may just have 2 barrels. Okay, the short barrel and the long barrel. The short barrel might contain top 20% of the most important 20% of the documents in terms of some importance measure. It has to be query specific importance or just the intrinsic importance. What do you think? If I'm doing barrels like this, should I consider query specific importance of the documents or the intrinsic importance of the documents?
Consider query specific, then there has to be different
Exactly. What I would really like to do is consider query-specific importance. But that just begs the question. You know, the way you figure out the query-specific importance is to rank them from 1 to 1 million and take the top 20% and say, this is my top barrel. But that's like dumb, because that's what you want to try and avoid. Okay? So you need some notion of intrinsic importance of a document. Okay? For example, hardcover books are books written by top authors. Are books, are articles published in prestigious journals, or in the case of web, what?
High page rank.
High page rank. Okay, we'll talk about page rank later, but I don't have to delude myself that you never heard of page rank. Okay, and so page rank is obviously completely query independent. Right? It's not about the query. It is about how important the document is just by itself, because many, many people apparently are likely to get to that page if they're just randomly surfing the web. So suppose then I actually put the top 20% of the documents in terms of the page rank into the short barrel, and then the 80% in the short, long barrel. Then what I can do is I can just look for my results in the first barrel, and if I get 10 results, I'll just not even go to the lower one. If not, I'll go to the lower one. This too is essentially an idea of trying not to do ranking of all documents that might contain at least one term, because simple vector similarity says that every document that will contain at least one of the terms will have non-zero similarity with the query. And so in the worst case, it could be in the top 10. And so you have to deal with that. You are trying to avoid doing this by taking all sorts of shortcuts. These shortcuts are all heuristics. They don't have to be right. There's no real guarantee that they're going to be right. Okay. But you can make reasonable arguments as to which shortcuts are better, which are worse. Right? For example, just the number of query words, putting a threshold on the number of query words is not as smart an idea as putting a threshold on the IDF of the query words that are not present in the document. Because IDF really is more application specific, and it tells you that of this guy's query, the really important part is the one that doesn't appear in most of the documents. Okay, and similarly, this other one is an orthogonal idea where you are doing intrinsic importance of the documents separately. Okay, using either a prestige of the forum where it is published, or whether it is has a ISBN number in Library of Congress, or whether it has page rank. Okay, and then you using that to cut down the amount of work you do. So the point that you want to remember is approximate retrieval is the order of the day. You cannot really do every possible non-zero rank. Non-zero similarity document and then do sorting. Okay. Now, there are also approaches which could take into account, which can guarantee that even though I'm approximating, the top 10 cannot possibly change. It's possible to do that. Okay. But those are going to be A, much more complex, and B, they're not going to be as effective most of the time, because they don't cut as many documents. Because if you want to ensure that in the worst case you will never miss a single result, you have to be very careful. Okay. That's all I have to say about indexing and retrieval. Okay. So I talked about the dumb indexing. I talked about inverted indexing. Inverted indexing has postings. Postings has a lot more information than I used in the example in my case, where basically I only used the document and the weight for the term. But normally you also have additional information such as the positions at which the word occurred in the document. And that is useful if you want to do proximity based retrieval. Okay? And I also pointed out that while the simple idea is to rank everything which has a non-zero similarity value, it would be useful to try not to even consider for ranking some of the documents, even if they have at least one of the terms. And those ideas would be either put a threshold on the number of terms that must be present in the document, and the threshold being greater than one, okay? And then R basically put a threshold in terms of IDF. R split the documents into barrels and then, you know, try to get our answers from the top barrel first. Okay. By the way, some of these IDFs that I would be talking about, it's sort of a mix. You know, traditional information retrieval people didn't necessarily spend all that much time trying to, you know, reduce the number of documents that they would rank, because the document corpus is not really all that big. Okay. It becomes much more of an issue in the web scale thing that we are going towards. Okay. And in fact, this idea of barrels of documents, it will come back in towards the end of today's class, where we will talk about distributed indexing. And one way of indexing, you know, indexing looks like it's a central thing. You know, somebody must keep all the index, right? But on the other hand, if you can somehow do it on a huge number of machines in a distributed fashion, that is much more useful. And one way you would wind up doing, essentially, is split the incoming documents into splits, you know, partitions, and do construct indexes for each of those partitions. I'll come back to this in a minute, you know, in several minutes later. But, you know, construct the indexes for each of the partitions and then merge them. And in doing so, if you made your original splits in such a way that the first split contains intrinsically most important documents, second split contains less important documents, and so on, then even before merging, you can start giving important results by just doing the index for the important barrel. And you will read all of this together in one fell swoop when, you know, after we are done with the social networks and the page rank stuff, you will, one class, will just read the old Google paper, the academic paper that they wrote before they became a company. And it's a good paper because it tries to put together, as of 1998, how did they design their search engine? Okay, and it would basically wind up using all these ideas to make it scale. Okay. Any questions on this stuff?
How do you determine the granularity of the buckets? I mean, the barrels.
There is no hard and fast rule. I mean, essentially, you depends. In terms of distributed indexing, the more splits, the better.
Yep.
Okay. But that's about it. I don't have any obvious. I mean, there may be heuristics, but I don't have anything that comes off my head. Any other question?
So, were you trying to say that when you split a document and the splitted things will go into different barrels?
The split thing we'll see in a minute. You know, if you have questions about how the indexing based on splits works, wait for a few. Or maybe actually, no, wait for a few minutes, because I do want to cover this, and if I don't cover the distributed indexing, I can still come back later. Okay. Okay, so that's the straightforward indexing and retrieval, and what we'll be talking about today, I mean, right now, is tolerant dictionaries. That means you wrote a query term, and that probably was misspelled, and so there may be real terms in the document. Maybe this term is not actually present anywhere in the collection, especially. So it's an empty set of results problem, in which case maybe you misspelled the query, and can you consider suggesting to the user what would be some of the correct words that are close to the word that she typed? Okay, now it turns out that this is actually it's a reasonable thing to do, and you know that it is done, because when you type a word, they will say, did you mean this? Okay, doing it right, and when it works right, you're very happy, because what you really want is for them to show you one correct word that you really wanted to type. If they show 15 words that are sort of close to your word and say, you know, maybe did you mean one of these, that's not as good. But what we'll do today is basically the beginning methods would at least be telling you how to generate candidate correct words that are close to your misspelled word. And then we will end it with a Bayesian way of actually ranking them in terms of the most likely misspelled word that you probably, I mean, most likely correct word corresponding to your misspelled word. On the way, actually, you'll learn two neat things. One is called, now basically notice that until now we've been looking at distances between documents, A query is a document, document is a document, we've been interested in distances between documents. Now we are interested in distances between words. Do you understand? And so in fact, it's cute that you now there is an interesting you know, isomorphism. There are some ideas such as k-grams, k-shingles will become k-grams in the context of words. A k-gram is a k-sized string. Okay, so you, if you have A, B, C, D, then a 2-gram would be A, B, B, C, C, D, and so on. Okay, those are the list of 2 grams. Okay, and the idea is, for example, if you misspelled, most likely what's going to happen is some of the grams, some of the k-grams are going to be the same between the correct word and the misspelled word. And so you can use the number of common grams as a measure. And in fact, to the extent you can think of, you know, k-grams as a bag representation of a word, because you could have the same bag multiple times in the word, so it's like, you know, bag representation of word, then you can use Jaccard similarity metric. Okay, previously we were using Jaccard similarity metric over bags where the entities in the bag were words. Now the entities in the bag are entities in the bag could be shingles, but now the entities in the bags would be grams. Okay, the other idea that we'll also look at is edit distances, which essentially tries to capture the way the misspelled word could have been produced. Okay, I mean, when you are typing, there are only certain types of mistakes you are likely to make, and other types of mistakes you are not likely to make. Okay, so here you are actually defining the distance. So let me first show you the k-gram idea, and then we'll come back to edit distance idea. Okay, so the k-gram idea, I have to skip over, but where am I? K-grams idea. So the k-grams is enumerate all the k-grams in the query term. Okay, and then use the k-gram index to retrieve the correct words that match the query term k-grams. Okay, now how you do that is that you have k-gram representation for all the dictionary terms too. Okay, and then you can compute a Jaccard coefficient. Okay, it turns out that Jaccard coefficient is general enough that if the query term and the dictionary term are differing lengths, it can still normalize which is closest, because it is actually the similarity here is being normalized in terms of union. Okay. Now, one point that is worth asking is, what is a correct term? So I gave a query term, and so when do I know that, first of all, when do I say that it's a wrong term, a wrongly typed term? And secondly, what is a correct term? Now, you could say a correct term is the term for which I have results in the postings dictionary, right? So one simple idea is to see, for each term in the postings dictionary, you know the total number of times this word appeared anywhere in the document, right? That's part of the inverted index across the corpus. Okay, so if I gave you a query, query term, and it seems to have occurred only like 7 times in the entire corpus, in fact, if it occurred 0 times in the entire corpus, then they have a problem. I have to actually solve the problem, because I can't give you any results. Okay, then I look for words which have occurred more times in the dictionary that are close to this. Okay, really what if, so there is this trade-off between thinking of lexicon, the inverted index lexicon as the real dictionary, versus thinking of Webster's dictionary as a standard dictionary. Do you understand what I'm saying? So there may be words that are present in the, you know, inverted index, but they're still wrongly spelled, because all of us are bozos and all of us are misspelling them, and so there is a misspelled word in the document corpus which has a very high frequency. Okay, so the question of what do you mean by correct is a subtle one. All I'm saying is go with the flow. You know, lots and lots of people seem to think of this variation of the word as more, I mean, this variation of the word has much higher TF across the document corpus. So maybe you are better off, that's what you meant, is what I'm saying. Okay? So we will assume that when we say correct words, we'll actually look at the index, posting index itself. Okay? And by the way, this is exactly what happens when, if you want to see which is the correct spelling of a word, then normally you say, you know, you give both the spellings that you have, and even before spelling correction started happening in search engines, they would give you at the top of the page, it occurs in gazillion billion documents, and this other word occurs in only 28 documents. And then to the extent you don't think spelling is particularly innovative to you and not to anybody else, you would go with the flow. You would go with what majority of people are spelling this word as. Okay, again, here is a situation where the fact that web is not random, it is bunch of documents made by other people who follow, tend to follow spelling conventions, is what is helping you. If web is a bunch of, you know, randomly generated documents containing randomly generated strings, then this makes no sense. Okay. Anyway, so you would do this correct, so you would connect for the, look for the correct words in terms of their k-gram, you know, for each word you have a k-gram representation of that word. Now, in the k-gram representation, first of all, there is this question as to what should k stand for. Is it bigrams? Is it trigrams? Is it, you know, quadgrams? And again, you assume some number. Normally, trigrams and bigrams are generally used. Okay. The other issue is, if I say trigram, do I only mean three-sized grams, or do I also allow bigrams and trigrams? What's interesting is that Jaccard coefficient doesn't care, because it's a bunch of grams, and then you essentially, if the same bigram or trigram are occurring in both the documents, it can handle that in terms of how, what's the minimum number of times it occurs in the intersection, and what's the maximum number of times it occurs in the union. Okay, and then all you would be able to do is compute the distances with the terms and throw out the top k terms as the possibly correct words that you meant to do. Okay, that's one way of spelling correction, really. Okay, now the other thing you could, so normally you could just give that word and say, did you mean one of these words? Or you could just use that word to do the retrieval. Okay, by the way, there is an interesting connection between what we were talking about in yesterday's class about correlation analysis, where you were trying, when the user said data, we also, database, we also wanted to throw in SQL. And here, where the user said a word and you are saying, why don't you take this other word too? So in both cases, you're changing the query. But the motivations are different. In this case, you assume that the user made a spelling error. And so you have to change the word. And in the other case, you think that there are synonyms. And so to compute the synonyms, you did the correlation analysis, and then you expanded the query. So there are obvious connections in places. But and just as I said yesterday, if you do find other terms that the user might have meant, that you think the user might have meant, you want to show it to them and say, did you want to type this? And let them click on that query, rather than just say, you know, you're a bozo, you don't know what you're looking for, I will give you the right, correctly spelled word, because maybe I want to know how many people spell this word the way I want. Okay? Maybe I'm trying to find people who are actually looking, you know, who misspell this word in this way because there is something particular about those documents. Okay? So it's a minor thing. You do not disempower the user, you show the possibilities. Okay? So that's about k-gram thing. The other idea is in k-grams, you really do not have a model of how the misspelling occurs. Okay, there is no generative model of misspelling, the spelled words. So you have no idea of what likely things are, what kinds of errors are more likely because of typing errors, and what kinds of things are less likely because of typing errors. For example, how many of you know why the keyboards that we use use QWERTY system. You know, it's called QWERTY keyboard because it has QWERTY in one of the rows. Do you guys know why that was the way it is done? Why can't you just put A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H on top, you know, the rest of the next line, etc. How many of you know?
Convenience.
What's convenience?
This is I mean frequency and interchange.
No, no.
It's very inconvenient because typewriter
keys
used to get hung when you...
Exactly. It's solving a problem. The old typewriters that many of you are too young to even remember, right, used to have, you know, when you type, you know, it's a hardware thing. So when you type a key, then something in the typewriter hangs up. It's like a piano, you know, hangs up and hits the paper. Now, if you type two letters together, two of your keys come up at the same time, get stuck in the middle. At which point, you open the typewriter, remove these two keys, put them back into their places, and start typing. This was a pretty big pain in the beginning typewriters. So somebody came up with what are the words that are likely to come next to each other, what are the letters that are likely to come next to each other, and put them as far in the keyboard as possible so that you are less likely to type them fast. Do you understand what I'm saying? Right? So they were trying to stop this. That's why QWERTY system is invented, and in fact, now this is nonsensical because we don't need QWERTY system. But just like any of these things, like, you know, we probably don't need to eat pizza either. It would be so much nicer if somebody can fax food to us, email food to us. Okay, but we evolved to eat stuff. So we still cannot eat by email, right? And so we are stuck with it. And similarly, we evolved with QWERTY system. So if somebody changes the keyboard, it's painful. Okay, exactly like that Russian experiment where for a while they took a bunch of people and gave them upside down glasses. So their glasses completely, when they put their glasses on, then the world looks upside down. In the first day they kept falling down. After a week they got completely used to it and they were just living in the world just as well as you and I were doing. And then after about 2 months when, you know, police came to arrest the scientist or something, they removed the glasses and they started falling again. Because they got used to upside world, upside down world, and now they don't know how to deal with the other one. So it's all a question of what you got used to. Okay? And QWERTY system was really to stop those errors. And what this all means is you would have designed the keyboard knowing how how people type and how letters come next to each other in normal English words. For example, Q and U come close together in most words. So QWERTY system makes it in such a way, I don't even know where the letters are, by the way. I have to see it. My hands know, I don't know. So in such a way that Q and U cannot be typed by just two fingers next to each other. Q is here, U is here. So you will type Q with this if you know touch typing. And if you're pecking, no problem for you, okay? and Q here, and then you reach over and type U. This is inefficient. And there are many other typewriter keyboard layouts which are much better, but nobody uses them other than Bozos because their efficiency Bozos, and they have been shown that those new typewriter layouts are much faster, but nobody uses it anyway. The whole reason I brought this up is you need to take into account the model by which the words come into being. Okay? And so certain types of errors are more likely, certain types of errors are less likely. Okay, QWERTY system makes sense because Q and U come together in the language and people tend to stress both of them at the same time and they'll get stuck keys and they have to undo that. Okay, so in the edit distances too, you consider types of errors that can occur and you essentially consider how many errors should you have done to go from this word to this word. Okay, and these are all the editing errors, edit operations. Okay, so for example, the additions could be things like insert, delete, replace, transpose. Those are the kinds of errors that you can make. Okay, and so basically edit distance between a string S1 and a string S2 is the minimum number of basic operations that are required to convert, minimum number, remember. Of basic operations that are required to convert one string into another string. Yes?
English language color and color spelled differently, like in the US dictionary is COLOR,
mm-hmm.
and the British is COLOUR. So will that be considered as a error, or is it considered to be a...
Again, as I said, that's a different issue as to when do you decide that people are making a mistake versus people know what they are looking for. Okay, this is why you have to have, so in essence what they are looking at, you know, in trying to decide something is correct or not, is in terms of the TF part of the postings list of the term. And so if you write COLOUR, even now it is the case that they will say, you know, maybe you want to say COLOR, because there are many more occurrences of COLOR, because, you know, in this one case actually American English is easier on spelling, and so you don't have to put that extra U. And so more people are using it. That's all it means. It's not that one is right, one is wrong, it's just more people are using it. Okay? Now you have to remember, of course, that as I said, in fact, the words that have lowest number of postings may actually be more important. Exactly, because they have low IDF. That, okay, so you cannot just, zero is very bad thing because it has infinite IDF, but that also means that there is no document that has that, you know, that would be correct for that word. But, you know, low, you know, there are only 100 instances of this. Is that considered close to zero or just a good IDF? Again, a threshold. You put a threshold and say, if the word has postings that's less than certain number, then you would start doing the spelling correction. Okay? Again, heuristics, and it depends on the document corpus. Okay? 6 is a very small number if you have 8 billion documents, and 6 is a pretty large number if you have 100 documents in the corpus. Right? So the edit distance basically counts the number of basic operations, and so there's one very well-known distance called Levenstein distance, and this counts only these following basic operations: insertion, deletion, and replacement. Inserting an extra letter, deleting one of the letters that is actually present in the word, and replacing one letter by another letter. So it's like together, insert, you know, delete and then insert. But you count that as one operation. Okay, now if you did not have replace, then something which actually, you know, if I had a word TOD, another word TKD, then the distance for them would be 2, because you have to remove O, put K. If you allow replace, then it would be 1, because just O became K. And similarly, this other one, a variation, Damoreau-Levenstein distance, there are many, many variations of this. What's more interesting is for you to know that these kinds of distance metrics exist, and this sort of makes sense, okay? And these distances, basically, this one also takes a transposition as a possibility. Now, why is transposition a possibility? Because, in fact, sometimes when you're typing, you get able becomes able many, many times, because the split second timing was such that you split on, you know, the hit on your, the second word, second letter came before the hit on the first word, and so they got transposed. So now if you do not have transposition as part of the thing, then if you have TOBD, and then this one is TBOD, according to the Damoreau-Levenstein, this is just one distance, because all you need to do is one transposition and you'll get the other one. But obviously, according to the Levenstein, it would be more, because you replaced O by B, you replaced B by O. And if you don't even allow replacement, it's 4. You removed O, I mean not 4, at least 3. So you removed O, so then it becomes TBD, then you inserted O back. So it's only 2 words, two operations. Okay, yes, sir.
This problem is like the thing.
Yes, yes. And you know how they do this? Exactly using that same kind of dynamic programming idea.
The difference is, in that case, they have a metric. They is replaced, but then I will give a penalty or reward of certain amount. So in this case, we just only have a default zero.
Weighted distance. So the first idea is to just assume that all operations have unit cost. Second idea is to basically see that different kinds of replacements are more versus less likely. Different kinds of deletions are more versus less likely. Different kinds of additions are more versus less likely. So you provide a weight to each of these operations, elementary operations. And you, instead of adding up once, you now add up non-uniform costs. Okay, and then you'll get the minimum distance. Now, it turns out that actually computing Levenstein distance is not as easy, because you know it's essentially a dynamic time warping idea. You have a small word and a large word. How do you decide where the error started occurring? Okay, it turns out that in fact this is a kind of problem that occurs in many situations. This is basically called a general idea is dynamic time warping. And one, it is useful, for example, another completely different situation where it is useful is speech recognition. Okay? So if you have words, I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and somebody says 1, 2, 3, etc. Right? And some people go fast in the beginning, slow down, and go fast again. Okay? So it's not, what you're trying to do is look at some signal to another signal. And you want to see what is the farthest they are. Okay, and if you don't take into account the time dilation aspects, then you would start thinking their distances are higher than is possible. So in some sense, what you do in all these situations is first find the if you conceptually want to think about it, find the best possible time dilation hypothesis that would make these two guys as close to each other as possible. And then at that time, take what is the distance. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you really want to give the most benefit of doubt, even with all the benefit of doubt in terms of time being dilated, you would still have this much distance at least. That's why the edit distances are always minimum distances, right? If you don't say minimum, I can do all sorts of things. You know, how did TOD become TKD? Well, I removed O, then I put a J, then I removed J, I put an M, then I removed M, I put a W, then I replaced it with something else. After the end of the day, I finally did the last operation. You can put any, you know, nonsensical distance as you want. The question is, given the best possible alignment of these words, what's the minimum number of operations you still have to do to make one into the other? Okay, whenever you have this kind of a scenario, the conceptually, it essentially says first find the best alignment and then with respect to that find the distance. But you want to really do it together, because computationally you want to do the alignment and computation of distance at the same time. And dynamic time warping algorithms wind up using dynamic programming approaches. And Levenstein distance is computed basically normally using a dynamic programming algorithm. And you can look up the exact details of the algorithm in the chapter in the IR book. Okay, I wasn't planning to cover it today, but it's very much relevant to, it's exactly the same kind of issue that happens in sequence alignment, same kind of issue that happens in the speech recognition, isolated word or continuous word speech recognition. Okay, so you're giving the most benefit of doubt for the kinds of things that are likely to happen anyway, and still with after that you're trying to see what's the minimum distance that's possible. Okay? So as I said, the actual distances, you could all assume that, this point about the fact that you first provide the best alignment and then find the distance is much more deeper point than the other one, which is different distances have really different penalties. Okay. In fact, it's a very interesting question as to who are you penalizing? What's the penalty supposed to mean? Okay. In fact, we'll talk in a minute that really the question is the likelihood of that happening. It has to be connected to the likelihood of that happening. You know, the more likely versus less likely, a particular error is, you have to take that into account in differentiating the errors in terms of uniform versus non-uniform cause. Okay. Anyway, as I said, weighted distance, there are variations of that Levenstein ideas which take into account different weights for each of the elementary operations. Okay, I mean they can not only take different weights for inserts are costlier than deletes, replaces are costlier than both of them. You can be even more picky and say replacement of B by L is much more likely than replacement of B by Q. That's really what you want to capture. So whenever people start jumping up and down about weights, there is always a question of where do you get the weights. I can write an algorithm if you give me the weights, and it's an interesting enough question as to how to write an algorithm. It has to be a dynamic programming algorithm. But the interesting issue is, the second interesting issue is, probably in some sense, the first interesting issue is, how do you decide what the weights are? You have some model about what errors are more likely and what are less likely. And you really want to learn them. Okay? And so the best spelling correctors right now actually learn them from the corpus. Learn these kinds of weights from the corpus. Okay? Anyway, so whether you have edit distance or the k-gram distance, what you wind up doing is basically, as I said, given a word, if you think its number of occurrences are small enough in the postings list that it's probably a misspelled word, then you start doing the spelling correction. Okay? And then you consider the top k words that are closest in terms of distance from this word, and then potentially the minimum you can do is show them off. A better idea would be to rank them. And basically, I mean, you can just say lowest distance. If in fact these weights are set correctly in terms of the most likely errors getting high weights, low weights, most likely errors getting low weights, and then these are distances, so you would wind up getting the most likely misspellings of this word as the highest ranked choices. So you can just take the top one and show it to the user. Okay? Okay. Now, one thing, of course, is you have to realize that, in a way, this step is important. One thing that you could do is, in terms of edit distance measure, this is actually a very useful thing you can do for edit distance, which is, given a word, since you know that only errors that are allowed are replace, delete, and if it's simple Levenstein, it's replace, delete, and insert. Okay. Now, suppose I make an assumption that nobody makes more than one error. Okay, then one way of actually, again, I could say that once I know the distance measure, I compare every possible word in the dictionary to my word and see their distances and rank them. That would be just like ranking all documents in terms of similarity to the query. And we spent a bunch of time trying to say, reduce the number of documents you're going to rank because it's going to be too costly otherwise. So now I want to do the same thing for words. Reduce the number of words that are going to be ranked. And it turns out that the edit distance has this property that you can use it as a generative model. K-gram distance doesn't have that property. Okay? Edit distance, since errors are occurring, there are only like three types of errors that can occur. And if you assume that a misspelling which contains at most one error is together much more likely than a misspelling that contains at most two errors, okay, then one idea would be to essentially only rank among all one error variations of the current word. One error variations of the current word. Okay, so given a word, you generate all possible one error replacement ideas for this word. Okay, insertion ideas and deletion ideas. Okay. Just one error. That means one letter being deleted, one letter being added, one letter being replaced. But of course, anywhere in the word. So you'll get a huge number of potential strings. Okay? Then you intersect that strings with the postings list, which is basically the correct words. And only those now are they're all basically equally good in terms of the number of errors. They're all exactly one error. And just show them, for example. And if you have weight, then you can now, at that point of time, take that weight into account and show them. Okay? So, in fact, here is a little, you know, if you can do one thing after this class, go to narvik.com spellcorrect.html, which is a very little Python program that does spelling correction. Okay? And it does it also taking into account Bayesian approach, which I'll say in a minute. But the reason, I mean, this is the entire program in Python. Okay? And one thing that I want you to see is this part. They're essentially given the word, they are essentially generating all possible one error new strings from the first word. And I'm making this assumption that one error words are all together more likely than two error words. Okay? And then consider those, and then if you intersect it with the postings list, then you know actually which of them are still words, in the sense somebody else also typed them. Okay? By the way, whenever I'm saying this, one interesting thing with respect to yesterday's discussion is anytime I think of postings list with respect to documents, I can also have a query log in the context of search engines. Everything I said here could also be done with respect to that, and the meanings would be somewhat different. Okay, so for example, I could see which are the query terms. So if you have a huge query log, then you can construct, again, the entire, you know, inverted index for that query log too. We really don't want to get the exact query log back to any, you know, exact query of somebody else back to you. But it sometimes is done. You know, people who are starting with this word seem to be adding these other words in their queries. And how did Google did do that very quickly? Basically, it has an inverted index, you know, to capture them. Okay? And you can also compute things like which words are more likely to be present in the queries, which words are less likely to be present in the queries, as against which words are more likely to be present in the data, in the documents, versus which words are less likely to be present in the documents. And these are two different things. What I like to query about doesn't have to be one and the same as what is actually present in the documents. These are different statistics, and you could use them too. Okay? Okay. And then, so the last thing that I want to say is that if you go and read, Narvik's spelling corrector, it brings all of these together in terms of edit distances, except it doesn't describe the entire idea of edit distance. It mostly is looking at generating one error terms, one error strings. Okay? But then one thing that they do is to provide a, until now you sort of said distances and, you know, whichever is close by. Now the problem is close with respect to the distance you define. Does your distance have anything to do with the reality? Okay, there's always that question. Okay, so a Bayesian model would essentially do something like this. In essence, what you're trying to do is given a dictionary of words and a complete or partial typing of a word. Let's assume for now that a complete typing of a word. Okay, you want to give the user a word from the dictionary that is probably the most likely correct version of the word that they typed. Okay? So in essence, what you're trying to do is compute this conditional probability for every correct word. What is the probability that that is the correct word given W is the word that the user typed? And if you have a way of computing these probabilities, right, then all you want to do is take the maximum of those and give that word, the word, the correct word which is most probable given the word that's typed. Okay? Now, whenever you have a conditional probability, if you remember your Bayes rule, PC given W can be written as PW given C times PC by PW. And the advantage is those numbers can actually be assessed from the data corpus. Okay? So in particular, you really try to do argmax over this expression. Now, PW is common for all of them. So really, it doesn't matter. You don't even need that number because the order would be the same whether you whatever the value of PW is. So what I really need is PC and PW given C. Now what is PC? This is something that we haven't talked until now, and it, you know, Bayesian model right away brings up close, which is probability, the prior probability that a word C would be something that people might want to type. Prior probability, just the prior probability. Okay? So is it a frequently used word or is it not a frequently used word? If it's a frequently used word, then its probability is high. If not, it's less. Okay? And so again, this is, you know, whenever you do this Bayesian rule, right, it's like diagnosis. You have a symptom and you're trying to guess what the disease is. And, you know, in doing this, of course, you have to take into account how likely is the disease to begin with. Okay? And so this is basically the language model. This is, in some language, in a given language, certain words are used more often than certain other words. That's it. Okay? So PC is high, in essence, could mean that it's connected to IDF being low. It's used a lot more. Okay? And the other one is, what is the probability that if what you wanted to say is C, you would instead type W? That's your error model. That's the likelihood of making different kinds of errors. Now it turns out that all I discussed about edit distances and the weights for them and saying that all words with one error are more likely than all words with two errors, all of those are about, you know, assumptions about your error model. Okay? And so the probability that that you do this, and then the different kinds of errors, and in particular you can provide using the, you know, the edit distance, basically saying only certain types of errors are possible, and the weighted distances will say which errors are more likely and which are less likely. And you can compute these numbers if you keep track of a large number of spelling errors and use them. So that's how you would use, in essence, the scale, the weights. Okay, I would strongly urge you to look at this. He nicely describes this idea and also writes a little program for it. Okay, and then I guess I think since I started 3 minutes late, I will, let me more or less end now. But I want to actually mention, this is something that we can come back and do, the distributed indexing, we can come back and do when we are talking about web search, because that's where it's done most. Okay. But in general, the issue is, in when you're doing web scale indexing, you're trying to not put the entire index into the main memory. This is again indexing stuff in the context of web. And you're not going to be able to put it on a single machine, and the more you can parallelize it, the more you can distribute it in multiple machines, the better off you are. And the question is, what's the best way to do that? Okay. And then another issue, of course, which is related, is that, you know, this has become now commonplace. Now the biggest secret about Google is not PageRank. That's a non-secret. They don't use it. You know, they just give it to you so you feel good about it. But PageRank is like one of the 250 metrics they use in ranking the pages. Okay? It makes for a good lecture in a class, but really that's not the thing. The biggest trade secret is Google data centers. The number of cheap Linux machines they keep adding. Okay, they never tell this to you, and they'll let you guess, and they'll put a, you know, they basically, it's good for them to not say how many machines they're using, because it's easier to have somebody try and compete with you by underestimating how hard it is to compete. Then they'll fail, and then you will still continue being there. Okay, and here is a reasonably educated guess. But it's just a guess, okay? And one of the points being made is that about 10% of the computing capacity of the world is in these data centers, okay? And they are cheap, they can die. If you die, you throw in another machine, and it's completely fault-tolerant distributed computing. That's really the big issue as to why Google works. And in fact, there is this article that I would try to send you a copy of. Basically, people don't get to work. Much of our computing is done on essentially single machine, maybe with multiple cores. Okay, you don't even know what to do if you are given a million machines. How do you do it fast? Whatever you're doing faster, you know, if you have a million machines. And this is all about coarse grained parallelism. You know, quickly doing, taking a certain task and splitting it in such a way that different machines can do that, and you can merge without wasting too much time. And certain kinds of computation are actually quite well suited for that kind of parallelization. And the thing that you keep hearing, map reduce architecture, which I was going to talk about, but I will do when we again talk about this topic, either on Friday or maybe later, is basically about coarse grained parallelism on multiple cheap machines. Okay? And then, in fact, there is this article that I was telling you about in Business Week a couple of year or two back, which essentially takes the view that there really are only 3 or 4 computers in the world. These are the important computers. Okay? I have to break it to you. Your computer isn't one of them. It doesn't matter if it dies. You know, if it dies, nobody cares. Okay? The computers that matter now increasingly are if a big search engine such as Google dies. Okay? Amazon dies. You know, that's when you have a problem. Now you can say, well, that's not one computer, that's a billion computers, but really it provides you the view of a single computer. It's just a single Amazon server, but behind it are, you know, gazillion, billion, not billion, you know, millions of, or, you know, tens of thousands of cheap machines. And there are all these systems issues. That's not exactly the main point of this course, but you cannot escape from it if you really want to do fast indexing and retrieval, and not worry about finding the costly machine. So in fact, the old way of improving speed is to give money to Seymour Cray, who is the Cray computer guy, who then make the system a little faster and then take exponentially larger amount of money. And now that's over. Now it is all of these cheap machines. In fact, you know, it's hard to tell where these search engines like Google buy their machines. And in fact, there are sites out there which track, you know, where are the large scale orders from Google going to, right? And there are people who are desperately trying to guess this number, and it's a useful thing to try and do. And you know, but they wind up, they don't buy it from Dell. You know, it's too costly. They buy it, you know, cheap machines, and if they die, you throw it out. Okay? And so this distributed clusters is the big issue. That's part of life. In fact, I believe there is this one huge data farm in between Oregon and Washington border. You know, I mean, I guess it would look like that picture that I showed you earlier, you know, except, you know, Hadron Collider is between Germany and Switzerland, and we people don't care about universal truth, so we just do data centers in between states, okay? And nobody knows how many exact number of machines are there, but it's an issue that is important. And what we'll talk about is how to parallelize indexing, for example, such that if you have all these machines, you can do it faster. And those of you who thought about parallelization at all know that not everything can be parallelized. Just because you have more machines doesn't necessarily mean you can do it faster. In fact, there are certain computations that are inherently unparallelizable. Okay? There are certain other computations which are inherently parallelizable. Okay, so it turns out the first question is the kind of computation that I'm interested in doing, which is this inverted index computation and then doing ranking of our documents. Is it actually parallelizable? And it turns out it is. And you can use things like map reduce kinds of ideas. And we'll at least talk about what are the tricks that you would do, you know, for the indexing phase and the retrieval phase. Maybe I'll show you this picture. This is what we'll talk about later. But, you know, this is where that splits comes. The reason you want to split the documents into multiple small barrels is because that's how you can then say, you deal with this, split. You deal with this other split. And then a bunch of other guys will then merge the, indexes for each of the splits. Okay. Now, this is actually an issue of programming. You know that learning to program in a new language, you know, even though I would like to say you should know, it's not easy, really. Right? I mean, if you want to suddenly start writing programming in Prolog, you don't know how to write them. You need to take a while to know how to say what you want to say in Prolog. And, you know, map reduce kind of architectures which essentially, you know, here is a little program for index construction in the MapReduce sort of a scenario. And MapReduce, by the way, are two constructs in Lisp. Okay, mapping a, so it's like something like if you want to map a particular, so you in Lisp you can write the following thing: map so here is a list, and I'm doing this operation, increase by one. And I'm mapping it onto this entire list. So this becomes two, this becomes three, this becomes four, this becomes five, this becomes six. And then I can put outside of it reduce with another operation plus. What that means is when I'm done with this operation, I get this list. I reduce this entire list by adding all the numbers together. I get a single number. This is not that different from what you need to do in computing the vector similarity. There is a map phase, which is compute the component of each of the query terms that each of the query terms provides to the similarity value of each of the documents. The reduce is add them up. That's the total similarity for that document. Okay. And it doesn't look like majorly hard parallelism, but essentially that's the kind of thing that works very well if you have many cheap machines and you don't want, this is like high level parallelism. This is not parallelism at the instruction level. This is parallelism at the machine level. Okay? We'll talk about this more when we get to search engines. I'll stop here right now. Okay? Thanks.